Hey, it's Brother One.
And Brother Two.
From Two Brothers Mattress.
You'll spend 33% of this year on your mattress.
That's almost 3,000 hours.
Start sleeping comfortably now on a new Tempur-Pedic mattress.
Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
With our lowest price guarantee
and our 100-night trial,
your locally owned Two Brothers Mattress is your number one choice for Tempur-Pedic mattresses. Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
twobrothersmattress.com.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KSL at Night. I'm your host this evening, Leah Murray. I am KSL's in-house resident political science professor. And I'm here to chat about all the things you need to know to be able to understand everything that's going on in the political world around you. If you're listening and you kind of missed something, you can always catch everything we're doing later on our podcast. KSLpodcast.com is where you can find that. Or honestly, anywhere you get podcasts, you can find it. So let's start the show off with some news that I saw that has to do with an election cycle, but thank goodness not about the presidential election cycle, because that feels very angry, but about our Senate race here in the state of Utah. There was an article in the Deseret News talking about the most highly competitive primary Senate race in over 30 years, and that lots of money is rolling in. So I'm just going to lay out the context. Brent Hatch was informed that the Virginia-based conservative outsider Political Action Committee committed $1.8 million for his primary campaign. That's the biggest number, so it's more than anyone else has received. John Curtis received $968,000 in ads from the Conservative Values for Utah Political Action Committee, which you might remember is the one that encouraged him to run, had those beautiful ads a little bit ago on television. They were the ones who ran those. And then we've got Brad Wilson's got $433,000 for ads. Jason Walton's got $290,000 for ads in the last few weeks. There was a poll conducted in January that said about 50% of Republican voters, they don't know which Senate candidate they want. Curtis had 18%, Hatch had 14%, Wilson had 8%. I'm bringing on someone much smarter than I am about all this stuff, Taylor Morgan from Morgan & May, and one of my favorite co-hosts here at KSL at Night. Taylor, welcome to the show.
Leah, you're too kind. Thanks for having me.
Taylor, did I get any of that context wrong? Or is there something like you would want to add to what we're talking about when we're thinking about this?
No, I think you hit everything correctly, Leah. I think that the one piece of this that I think is so fun and so interesting, a little piece of background for your listeners, is that this big $1.8 million ad buy, now technically it is a time reservation in anticipation of the full ad buy.
So what does that mean? Tell me what that means right there.
That means that groups who have money to spend try to buy up time in elections as early as possible to get the best possible rate for airtime during a competitive election cycle. For example, to be specific, the Utah Republican Senate primary cycle. Airtime in Utah is quite cheap relative to other television markets. And so $1.8 million of ad time is quite a significant buy. This $1.8 million was spent by an outside, out-of-state group called Conservative Outsiders PAC. What's fun about this is they bought the ad time in support of Brent Orrin Hatch, also known as Brent Hatch. Conveniently, he has been sure to include the name Orrin, his father's name, Orrin, the late Senator Orrin Hatch. The full name will be on the ballot. I think that is obviously helpful for Mr. Hatch. But what is particularly fun about the Conservative Outsider PAC buying nearly $2 million of airtime in support of Brent Orrin Hatch is the fact that the principal funder behind the Conservative Outsiders PAC is the Club for Growth. And anyone who knows Utah political history will recognize the name Club for Growth, because they also spent big money in Utah to try to defeat Brent's father, Orrin Hatch, years ago when he was running for re-election. And Orrin Hatch at the time, Senator Orrin Hatch, criticized that as an outside organization trying to meddle in Utah politics. Now the exact same donor has come in a big way in support of his son.
Yeah, no, I love the, is that irony, Taylor? I'm not sure. when I was reading that, I was like, that's very interesting. Can you help me figure out, so the article said it's the most competitive race in 30 years. And I wanted to know if you thought that was accurate, because I was thinking about 2010, when Bennett didn't make it through convention and we get a primary between Lee and Bridgewater. Was that not as competitive? Am I just not remembering that accurately?
Well, I'm not sure that it's quite accurate to say it's the most competitive. However, I think that in a way that is fair, because I will say that this U.S. Senate seat, this open U.S. Senate seat, which only comes around very rarely here in Utah, we have a field, probably, I would argue, the most qualified field of competitive candidates for an open Utah political seat that we have seen in decades. We have so much money flowing in independently on behalf of these candidates, not just Brent Orrin Hatch, but also John Curtis has had significant dollars come in for independent advice. We know that just in terms of name ID, Congressman John Curtis does have an advantage. However, former Speaker of the House, Utah House, Brad Wilson, is spending big and has resources. Brent Orrin Hatch performed well in the first poll. I think it's safe to say that 14% of Utah Republicans aren't aware that his father has passed away. So having the name Orrin on the ballot certainly is helping Brent in that way.
All right. So talk to us a little bit about who's on this ballot and that poll, right? So I cited a poll that was from January, but I feel like, Taylor, that's a million years ago in political time. So there's got to be more recent polls. Or, I mean, candidates must know how they're doing. Is there any sense of all of this money that's pouring in moving the needle at all for any of these candidates in any direction?
Well, it hasn't quite moved the needle yet, Leah. Like I mentioned, with a little bit of sarcasm there, Brent Orrin Hatch, I think, surprised a lot of people with how well he performed in the latest poll at 14%. Brad Wilson is doing reasonably well. As I mentioned, Congressman John Curtis is out in front of the pack. I think that is primarily due just to name ID. Of course, we have Riverton Mayor Trent Staggs is in the race. We have Republican far-right conservative Carolyn Phippen, and many others. It is a very, very crowded field. If you drive along I-15 along the Wasatch Corridor, you will see billboards for a number of candidates you've never heard of. So there is money pouring into the race, Leah, but I will say that these big ad buys are reservations of ad time, and they have not yet moved the needle in terms of communications to boost the numbers of any one candidate in particular. It's certainly possible they could have an impact in the future. Really, Leah, what I am watching for is who comes out of the state convention on April 27th. And then based on who has qualified for the ballot with signatures, and that is still yet to be determined, the deadline for that is mid-April. So once we know who will be on the primary ballot via signatures, and once we know who comes out of convention after April 27th, Leah, that is really when we'll have a sense of who's competitive in this race. All of the polling numbers up to date really have not been predictive of any kind of outcome. But I would say that Curtis is doing well with name ID. Brad Wilson has to make up some ground. Brent Orrin Hatch, Leah, if I have to say so, he needs a whole lot more out-of-state money to help him out if he's going to pull this off. But he is my dark horse favorite at this point.
Oh, I love that. You have a dark horse favorite. Taylor Morgan, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
All right, listeners, next up on KSL at Night, we're going to turn to what is maybe the most important issue on the table right now that we, I think, as a society have to collectively solve, which is mental health issues among our youth. We will dive into it after the break.
I'm Jeff Kaplan from KSL News Radio. You want to receive the latest news, traffic, and weather all in one place? All you have to do is subscribe to the KSL text line. Text the word NEWS to 57500 and you'll get the latest news, traffic, and weather updates. Sometimes before we get them on the air. I'll catch you on the radio weekday afternoons on KSL News Radio.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at night.
Good evening and welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are talking about all the most important issues of the day. I want to just tell you, as a political science professor up at Weber State University, I often interact with young people who are dealing with mental health issues. In fact, this week, I want to say an hour of my time was having a conversation with a few students who were just hitting right up against a wall of having a really hard time. And with every conversation, I'm saying to the students, like, I am not a therapist. I do not have an expertise in this. And really, we have to make sure that we get you some help, knowing that mental health is so important, and also that the care providers are pretty overworked because a lot of people are having issues. So I'm mindful of why, you know, very much in my own professional life, how important this can be. Yesterday was the grand opening of the West High Clinic, which will be offering physical and mental health services to students on their campus. I imagine teachers there probably have similar stories to what I just shared with you, in that you're like trying to help students and you don't always have all the resources right at your fingertips to make sure they get the help that they need. This clinic is a collaborative effort between the University of Utah Health, the Salt Lake City School District, the Salt Lake Education Foundation, and I think it's the first in-school clinic in Utah at a high school. But to help me make sure I've got this all right for you, we've got James Yapias, the Senior Director of the Salt Lake Education Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate you being, talking with me with regards to the clinic today.
Yeah. So, James, first of all, did I get it right? Does that make sense? Like what I'm talking about, what you're doing there. And if I didn't, correct me.
Absolutely. So, first of all, you know, the clinic was in partnership with the University of Utah and the Salt Lake City School District. And we're thrilled about this incredible opportunity because we know that suicide is the cause of death amongst Utah teens ages 10 to 24, is the number one cause of death. And one of the reasons why we went right into this is to really provide those opportunities, bring the resources to the students, and make sure that our students are healthy and making sure that they're attending their classes and that someone does care and we're bringing the resources to them.
So can you talk to us about what... I mean, obviously, what you just said, suicide's the number one cause of death among young people. But what inspired you all, right, that this was the right way to do the work? Does that make sense? So we've got this problem. How, like, what made you all think having a clinic on site is the right way to do this?
Well, one of the things that, as a former school administrator, we found, in just talking to our colleagues, that there's a need for pediatricians, psychiatrists, psychologists in the schools, and there's a waiting list, three months up to a year in many cases. And so when we start talking about providing preventative care, immunization, sports physicals, and other preventative healthcare issues, we were talking about what if we could bring the clinic to the students. And quite often the students, you know, what we've talked to parents as well. The students don't worry about the preventative care. They go to school. Sometimes they're sick and they have to take some time off school and the parents have to take some time off. So we wanted to be innovative and we wanted also address the needs of our students and bring those resources to them. And that's what initiated the conversation.
Yeah, no, I love that. And thank you so much for reminding me. I'm thinking about mental health, but your clinic actually does physical health services as well, right? So the point you just said, like getting the sports physicals, right? I've got two teenagers and they're always like, oh, for you to do the cross country, I got to go, right? I got to get in and make sure I've done that. So the idea is the whole student. Does that make sense? Like it's all the care that they might need to be able to do all the fun co-curricular, extracurricular, also doing well in classes, all the stuff they'll need, you'll be able to service.
Exactly. And And that was the whole idea, too, is that if we can bring the pediatricians, the psychiatrists right to the school, and they don't, the kids don't have to wait to be able to see a psychiatrist in case of an emergency. And when they go to the clinic, it's an incredible environment, friendly environment. Within the first week, since the opening of February 26, we've already seen about 100 patients in the clinic. And it's been incredible. The momentum is there. We're so excited because our goal is to provide the services. Right now, we open it up to West High School, but by the end of the summer, it'll be all the high schools in Salt Lake City School District. So we're excited about that opportunity.
Yeah. All right. That seems like a major endeavor, right, James? I'm feeling like that's a lot of students and there's a lot of schools. How do you manage all of that work?
Well, it's a collective effort. I think we put first of all, I want to thank our district board members, foundation board members in the University of Utah School, of School of Health, that basically provided the resources and our donors, that believe in what we do. In Salt Lake City School District, we have 3 community learning centers where we actually have a clinic, but it's in a community setting. This one is in a high school where we're actually bringing the clinic right to the students. So it is a collaborative effort. It's taken us about 3 years to develop the clinic. And we wouldn't have been able to do this if it wasn't for our partners, Senator Escamilla, she was instrumental in also providing us the resources to be able to open the clinic at West.
So, James, talk to me about the fact that you just said over 100 students have already come in. One, did that surprise you or did that seem to be? So how do I say, given it was that number since February 26, are you worried about the demand? You know what I mean? Will you be able to meet it across all of the high schools? Or were you all thinking, no, that seems like the right number of kids we would expect once we opened our clinic?
I think that was expected, because we know the need is there, and many of our students have asked. It's incredible to hear their stories. As a matter of fact, we've talked to the students and parents, and so we anticipated that once we opened the clinic, it was going to get full pretty fast. And the need is there. The students understand it, and it's amazing to see the students talking to each other, sharing it with friends, that there is a place, in case certain things happen. Social emotional support for our students with additional psychologists and support and social workers, that is so important for us, and that's what we're doing. Again, it's a collaborative effort, and we did do a lot of marketing prior to it as well, so everyone understands the process, and that's what's been really important for us to make sure that the process is flawless, in that we're working to help the students at West.
So I like that right there. So what is, how you said, making sure everyone understood the process. So let's just lay that out for parents who might be listening, especially in the Salt Lake City School District, because this will be available for everybody in high school starting next year. What is the process? Like, what do students need to know? Like, I'm thinking, do they need an insurance card, James? I mean, like, how does that, right? Like, when they're walking through the doors, what does it look like for them?
Well, what it looks like, first of all, the counselors can refer the students and make sure that every student has the parents' authorization form signed, and making sure that they have completed that. In addition to that, CHIP and Medicaid, students that cannot afford, we have charitable funds that we use that they can apply for those resources. The foundation's also, always soliciting funds to be able to provide those opportunities for the students. One thing that we believe is no students will be denied, that will come in through the doors. Our students that are setting up those appointments. The UVU has their staff there ready to serve the students. They make their appointments And it's amazing that they're talking to each other. They're sharing the information with each other. They can go online. There's an online link that you can go to through the University of Utah Health. and it takes you right directly to where to make the appointment. And there are questions there that also answer in other languages, in Spanish, that will help them understand what the process is also for CHIP and Medicaid and how to apply for that appointment.
All right, James Yapia, Senior Director of the Salt Lake Education Foundation, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Okay, listeners, let's talk about housing affordability next on KSL at Night, because as it turns out, it's the number one policy priority for Utahns. We'll get into it after the break.
I'm Jeff Kaplan from KSL News Radio. You want to receive the latest news, traffic, and weather all in one place? All you have to do is subscribe to the KSL text line. Text the word NEWS to 57500 and you'll get the latest news, traffic, and weather updates. Sometimes before we get them on the air. I'll catch you on the radio weekday afternoons on KSL News Radio.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are talking about all the most important and interesting things. Last week, we talked about how expensive it is to live in Utah. And if you haven't heard that segment or you need to revisit, make sure to check it out on our podcast at kslpodcast.com or wherever you download your podcasts. So what we talked about, which I found absolutely stunning, is that we were third in the nation for housing being out of reach for people's income. First was Hawaii, didn't surprise me at all. California was second, that made total sense to me. And then third in the nation was Utah. And a little bit, the deal is when a place is amazing, it gets expensive to live here. So I wasn't surprised, although I guess I was surprised because I was stunned that we were third. I wasn't surprised that housing was an issue. I was surprised at how the list we were on, California and Hawaii, was the list we were on. And then it's interesting that a poll recently released shows that it's the number one issue that Utahns want legislators to focus on, right? So now it's not just, we all know it's really expensive to live here, and that's because it's fabulous and there are a lot of people here and there's not enough housing and rental prices are really high. But also it's the case that I guess Utahns are looking for the state legislature to solve the problem. It's the number one issue they want legislators focusing on, which also surprised me a little bit because it wasn't like water. I guess I thought it was going to be water, right? But no, it's about housing. So to help us figure out what those policy solutions might look like and what it is we are talking about, we've got with us this evening Steve Waldrip, the Senior Advisor for Housing Strategy and Innovation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, so first of all, make sure that I've laid out that context correctly. Tell us about this housing policy issue. What is happening that makes us be on a list with California and Hawaii?
Well, you nailed it. I mean, there are good problems in life and bad problems, and being an incredible place to live is among the good problems. It creates, you know, attraction, especially during COVID, when people found out they didn't have to go to work in an office somewhere. They could go wherever they wanted. And naturally, they wanted to come to a really cool and beautiful place where people are nice and there's great things to do. And so we experienced abnormal growth from external sources. But in addition to that, we have our natural growth, which is driving typically about 70% of our need for additional housing.
Okay, so you called it, in an article I read in the Deseret News, I think you said it's an existential crisis. So tell us like what that means and why, Steve, that this is the issue that maybe I'm thinking keeps you up at night, right? And why you want to spend your time figuring out the right solutions.
That was another headline earlier, is that it keeps me awake at night. So I am the Chicken Little apparently in Utah right now. The sky is falling. And we're having all kinds of problems, and that's just kind of how it is right now. I use the word existential crisis because I have no idea what it actually means. It just sounds really cool.
Oh, I love that. that's great. Yeah.
No, it's a crisis that goes beyond kind of what we normally consider. And here's the reason why I call it an existential crisis, because housing stability impacts so many things that we care about. It impacts our ability to have our family nearby, our ability to have our kids and our grandkids live near us, and to have that family closeness that is one of the most valuable things that we have here in Utah, that culture of family. Housing instability creates educational problems. Education achievement goes up with housing stability, home ownership. Community engagement goes up with home ownership and housing stability. Participation in civic and elections goes up. Teen pregnancy goes down. I mean, all of the things that we kind of care about have a tie into the ability of people to get roots, put roots down, and feel stable where they live. And we've lost a lot of that for our youngest generation. They're coming into the workforce, they're graduating from college, they're getting good jobs, and they're going, wait a minute, told my whole life that if I did the right things, if I went to high school and graduated, if I went to college or I went to trade school and I got a good job and a good career, and you know, I did all of the right things, I would be rewarded with the American dream. And they've done all of those things, and then they're getting to the point now where they're going, wait a minute, the American dream is not apparently for me anymore. It's out of reach. And so that's the existential nature of the crisis, is it's really threatening our core fundamental way of life in Utah.
Steve, I don't know how anyone's teasing you and calling you Chicken Little, because I think, oh my gosh, I'm with you completely, right? The answer, all of the indicators for happiness, right, go in the right direction if you have housing stability, if you have roots. I mean, I love the way you're talking about that. So I think you're exactly right on the problem. Does that make sense? So, you're not Chicken Little. I think you're calling it out. And also, the state agrees with you. It's the number one priority for people who live here. All right, so talk to me. What are the solutions, right? So what do we need to do to address this? And I feel like it's a collective problem, right? Like, we all have a role to play. What is it that we should be doing?
Well, the legislature did some really, really good things in this last legislative session. They created a housing ownership promotion zone. They passed some legislation around the creation of kind of moderate density midtown districts. They did what I think is the biggest thing, which was create the Public Treasurer's Investment Fund liquidity fund to allow for home builders to access capital that they're having a real hard time getting now because of the financial crisis, the banking crisis that we're also in the middle of. So our home builders are having a hard time getting capital. This frees up capital, but they have to build homes targeted to a certain price or below. They can't just build whatever they want. They've got to build homes that in the county that they're building are considered attainable homes. And the target is $350,000 or less. And the fact that we're talking about $350,000 starter homes, you know, it just blows your mind if you existed prior to 10 years from now. I mean, everybody I talked to said, well, my first home was, you know, $26,000 or $100,000. And that used to be the metric.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about $300,000 plus for our first home. And that's just the reality. So the legislature did some really, really good things. The $300 million Public Treasures Fund, that fund should have a direct impact on what is produced in Utah. And we see that as a very, very strong first step in creating more of the type of houses that we need. For the general public, we have really one thing that we have to do. We have to step up and realize and recognize that the problem is in our collective backyard. It's not to be solved in someone else's backyard. We can't send our kids there or there. We have to have them here. each neighborhood, each community has to absorb some of this growth. And growth is painful sometimes, but it doesn't have to be bad. We can do really good housing policy. We have very good community leadership that can help guide to create better density options, missing middle options where you have kind of hybrid housing solutions. But we can't simply say not in my backyard, go somewhere else and solve the problem. That just doesn't work anymore. We have to collectively decide that it is our problem to solve, and each community has to step up and do its part.
Steve Waldrop, I hear you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Every community's got to step up. Steve Waldrop, Senior Advisor for Housing Strategy and Innovation, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, next up on KSL at Night, let's get into the moving that's happening in our transit system. So how do we get people around our state? How do we move them around their neighborhoods and communities? Stay with us after the break.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we're talking about everything that's fun to talk about. And this morning, I was listening to KSL News Radio, as you should in the morning, so you know what's going on for your day. And as you probably are aware, they do traffic and weather every little bit on the 9. So do you know what is happening out there? Do you need an umbrella or not? And so this morning I was totally aware that traffic was not moving along I-15. And I legit thought to myself, I'm really glad I'm not headed into Salt Lake City this morning, or I'd be sitting in a parking lot out there on I-15 with everybody else who is trying to move around the state. There are a lot of people, and a lot of them are moving in a very narrow corridor. It's interesting, in the last segment we just talked about how housing affordability is the number one issue for people. But I'm just going to tell you what, when I am sitting in traffic on Harrison Boulevard up in Ogden, and I'm always, my kids would tell you, I'll say, clearly we're in a parade, everyone should wave to the people on the sidewalk because we're barely moving at all because it's just so packed. I am also thinking about transportation as an issue and transit and how we move around. I think there's got to be a better way, and I often think I should just buy myself a helicopter. But luckily, there are other people who are smarter than I am who are working on this issue, and they just released their 2050 roadmap. And we have got with us Alex Bame, the UTA Manager of Long-Range Strategic Planning, to help me not decide to buy a helicopter, but also to help all of us understand what's going on with our transit. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
So, Alex, tell us about this roadmap. So just kind of take us through, not like an hour-long lecture, right? But just kind of what are the big takeaways? What are the highlights? And what are your plans for the next, I think it goes till 2050, so for the next 26 years?
Sure. So this plan has been a process of an extensive collaboration with both our transportation partners at Metropolitan Planning Agencies, WFRC and MAG, as well as UDOT. We also have worked very closely with the communities along the Wasatch Front and also the public to come up with a list of priorities and things that we want to work on over the next 30 years. And some of the highlights I would call out would be some new local routes and high growth areas, more frequent service corridors. So frequency was a big thing that we heard about, was the need for service that comes more often, better service on Sundays. You mentioned, moving north and south on I-15. We're looking to do frequency improvements on Front Runner. And we always say the best ad for Front Runner is when you see it passing traffic that's standing still on I-15. So we're looking to make improvements on Front Runner, additional track service, and new what we call innovative mobility zones, which could be some combination of our existing on-demand service or a variety of other things.
Oh my gosh, you are not wrong, man. When you are sitting on I-15 and the Front Runner just flies by, and I always think to myself, why am I not sitting on that train, right? So let's talk about that frequency that you just mentioned. One of my issues often is it's not quite how do I say, I can't get to where I need to be. Either I'm there like 2 hours early or I'm really going to be late for what's happening. So when you're thinking about increasing the frequency of moving people around, how do you figure that out, right? Because I know it's not like a chauffeur, right? You're not showing up at my house exactly when I need you to be there and taking me somewhere, exactly when I need to be there. How do you figure out where your frequency is off? And how does that look as you're kind of like fine tuning that for the communities?
Sure. Well, we kind of see 15 minutes or better as being the real tipping point where you can stop thinking about a schedule, stop thinking about when I need to leave and being so concerned that you're going to miss the train or the bus and be stranded. So we're looking really across our system. Like I mentioned, Front Runner is one that we're looking to. We have a project underway in partnership with UDOT to improve to 15-minute peak service and 30-minute all day, and we're hoping to get that up to 15 minutes all day at some point in the near future. And then we're looking across like our bus network, which runs, you know, all along the Wasatch Front, and really focusing on places where we can get that service up to 15 minutes or better so we can really allow people to use transit without having to plan their day around it.
The other thing that I noted in the plan was, and what you also just mentioned it too, is the regular Sunday service for the first time. And I actually, for me, that's huge, right? We bringing people in when people come to visit, right? I always just say, oh, you can hop on the Front Runner, get on tracks, get on Front Runner, come on up to Ogden and I will meet you at the station. It's just a lot easier than trying to get to the airport to pick people up. And then if they're flying in or out on a Sunday, like that's just not an option. So I'm wondering, in the article you said soon, I love the word soon, Alex, right? So I'm trying to put you on the spot. But like, when are we thinking? Is soon 2049 or soon, like you've got some parts of this plan that you're doing, so the Sundays might be this year? Do you have an idea where we could learn when we think these new changes might be rolling out?
Right. Well, the plan is in three different phases that go in sort of 10-year increments, and we have proposed some of the Sunday service improvements and other things to happen within the next 10 years. A lot of that, it's based on financial assumptions, so it's contingent on us being able to make sure that we have the funding available to do these improvements. But we certainly recognize and realize that there's certainly changing travel patterns from, you know, the 9-to-5 Monday to Friday need for transit to a 7-day-a-week need and for more frequent service even on the weekends and on Sunday. So we're hoping to do a number of these things within the next 10 years, some of them even sooner. We have a 5-year service plan that's available online in addition to our long-range transit plan, where we kind of get closer, more things in focus, and we really outline what we're doing in the next few years.
Okay, I love the one of the quotes in the article was, we cannot address all of our needs with new roads or widened roads. And I think that might have been you, Alex, who said that. And that it has to be truly multimodal. What does that mean, right? So what are we talking about when you say multimodal? Like, what does that look like, right? When you're out in your community, what is that going to look like?
Sure. And I'll say that our partners at UDOT understand that as well, that you can't build your way out of congestion and there need to be transportation choices and alternatives. So that's really about exactly that. It's about creating different options. We know some people will still either want to or need to drive either with others or by themselves. But if we can enhance and increase our transit options and make that a good option for a larger amount of people, that really helps take more cars off the road and allows us to be more efficient in our whole transportation system.
Okay, Alex, I'm going to tell you, whenever they do these big projects, at least up in Ogden, I always feel like you all designed it in my commute so that I just will be annoyed the whole time that I'm driving to work in the morning. How do you, like, what will it look like? Does that make sense? Like, how will, as your plan, and I totally heard what you said earlier, it's 10-year increments. So I feel like it's not happening all at once. So it shouldn't be too disruptive, but what does it look like when you are serving growth areas and you're making these changes? Like, how disruptive does that become for the way that we're kind of used to doing things while we're all getting used to being multimodal?
Right. Well, that's a great point. And that's why, in some cases, to start, and especially for our growing areas along the Wasatch Front, we know we hear about growth all the time. A good first step is bus service, right? That you can get a bus in mixed traffic. You put up the infrastructure to support a bus. That really doesn't need to cause a disruption to the existing system. Now, you will eventually, if you transit's going well, you'll want to make additional improvements and have dedicated lane like some of our bus rapid transit system or a dedicated right-of-way rail system. Sometimes that can be parallel to a roadway or not in the roadway. But like anything else, there are sort of growing pains. But like I said, a key first step is something like bus service and our on-demand service, which operates on the existing roads and gives you a transportation alternative without creating construction problems.
All right, Alex Boehm, UTA Manager of Long Range Strategic Planning. Thank you so much for the work you do, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Listeners, thank you so much for joining us, listening to KSL at Night. If you want to listen again or just make sure that you've got everything, you understand it all, check out our podcast at kslpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.